It is gone! A two-run home run for Reese Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper.
Bang! And a miss! He got him!
And Aaron Nola leads two.
Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab!
Swing and a miss! Struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 324. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, what are the Phillies doing? Radio silence since the end of the season. We have not heard from anybody in the front office about the status of Gabe Kapler, or really just to give us their thoughts on the 2019 season. Joining me in just a few minutes is going to be Paul Boyer, one of our fantastic writers at The Good Fight. We're going to talk about the future of Gabe Kapler, talk a little bit about Matt Klentak as well, and we'll get into some other stuff about the Major League Baseball playoffs. I'm going to have some thoughts about the MLB wild card. I know a lot of people don't like it. They don't like the single game playoff. I will tell you not only why it's good, but why it's necessary and why it's the best thing for baseball. We'll do that coming up here in just a few minutes. Plus, I'll have your stat of the week. Just a reminder, folks, check out the Patreon for Hittin' Season. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. We've got some bonus content up there for you. I wrote my Major League Baseball postseason predictions there for you to get a good look at, and also have an interview I did on the WIP Morning Show up there. We've got some extra bonus podcast content. I've got some video content up there. Justin and Liz are going to kick in some extra stuff here during the offseason as well, so it's worth the $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season to get all that. Plus, you get priority on any mailbag episodes we do, and we'll have another one coming up in just a little bit as well. And don't forget to tell your friends about the Good Fight podcast feed. Tell them to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, Stitcher, wherever it is they get their podcasts. All right, let's talk about what the Phillies are doing, or I guess in this case more specifically, what the Phillies are not doing. And what the Phillies are not doing right now is talking. They're not saying much at all. They've been lying low since the end of the regular season. The Phillies, John Middleton and Andy McPhail in particular, have been... Is conspicuous the right word? I guess conspicuous in their silence so far. If we're looking back at the calendar for last year, Matt Klentak held his end-of-year news conference on October 1st, and Andy McPhail held his on October 2nd. So as I record this on October 3rd, still nothing from the team, and it doesn't look like they're going to do anything anytime soon. Jim Salisbury reported on Wednesday that no announcement was coming that day. Matt Breen said Gabe Kapler was still at Citizens Bank Park on Wednesday, working like normal despite his up-in-the-air status for 2020. And then Jason Stark tweeted that he's hearing buzz that it's possible there won't be an announcement until next week, which is much later than I think many of us were anticipating. And if the decision was simply going to be, we're letting Gabe Kapler go, that doesn't seem to me to be something that would take until next week to do. There are already, with the New York Mets announcing the firing of Mickey Callaway here on Thursday, there are already 7 managerial openings in Major League Baseball. The Phillies would be number 8. 7 teams have already made a decision on their manager. The Phillies have not. So obviously something is holding things up here. If this was just a matter of, because the Phillies, if this was just about Gabe Kapler, I gotta believe that looking at 2 straight seasons, 162 games each, that you wouldn't see what you needed to see during that time. They talked to the players last week. John Middleton was in Washington, D.C., having exit interviews with the players and talking to the coaching staff. And you would imagine that they've been having these discussions for the last couple of weeks. Frankly, they've been having these discussions since they let John Mailey go back in August. So if it was just a matter of Gabe Kapler being dismissed, you would think that it would have been done by now. Because typically, when a team lets go of a manager, they don't necessarily know who the next manager is going to be. They do a managerial search. They may have one or two guys in mind that they know they would like to talk to. Every once in a while, you have a clear successor in mind. But for the 7 teams that have already declared that they want a new manager next year, that they want to go in a new direction, nobody's hired anybody just yet. And typically Major League Baseball doesn't want anybody doing that until after the World Series is over anyway. So maybe that's why the Phillies feel there's really no big deal in waiting. But obviously something is being discussed. Otherwise, the normal end-of-year news conferences would have already happened. Now, there's a few different things that could be going on here. The delay could be due to simple indecision on the part of John Middleton, and maybe if Andy McPhail is a part of this conversation, Andy McPhail as well, and Matt Klintak. I think we're all pretty confident in the fact that Matt Klintak believes that Gabe Kapler is the right man for the job, and I would imagine there is probably some disagreement about that. Or maybe at the very least, they're not just going based off of what Matt Klintak thinks. John Middleton maybe wants to get some more independent verification. The other possibility is there, another possibility is they're waiting for a potential replacement to decide if he, what he wants to do before the Phillies decide to move on from Kapler. So if they know that they will, that they would only replace Kapler with, say, like two people, let's just say it's Joe Maddon and Joe Girardi, and they've decided, if we can get one of these two guys, we'll replace Kapler. But otherwise, we'll keep Kapler where he's at. If that's the mindset, then they might need to know what Maddon and Girardi plan to do, what their preferences are, before going ahead and making a decision on Kapler. It could be something where they decide, Kapler's good, we'll give him another year, unless Maddon or Girardi is available. We feel that they're a better option going forward, but everybody else is below Kapler. If that's the calculus, if that's what they're thinking, then they might be waiting on answers from Maddon and Girardi before deciding to pull the trigger. It's pretty unfair to Kapler, but that could be something that's going on. Or they're trying to decide on another role for Kapler. Scott Lauber mentioned that one in the Philadelphia Inquirer. If they are going to move on from Kapler, they may decide to try and reassign him in the organization, and then maybe that's part of the delay, Kapler figuring out where he wants to be. The Phillies reassigned Pete Maccannon at the after the 2017 season was over and made him a special assistant to the club. By the way, the Phillies fired Pete Maccannon after a very successful second half in the 2017 season with a bunch of young players. So it wouldn't necessarily have to be what happened on the field that determines whether or not the Phillies decide to make a move here. But here's the deal. As I said before, Middleton has seen this team for the last 2 years. And for, at the very least this season, 162 games, he had exit meetings with players all last week. They've been talking about this for weeks. So what is the holdup? If he's indecisive about this, I don't think it speaks very well to his leadership skills. If all we're talking about is Kapler here, and he's hemming and hawing and going back and forth and talking to a lot of different people, I mean, maybe that's an unfair characterization of what's happening here. We don't really know because there's just been a lot of silence. It's not clear what's going on. So this is speculation on my part. But at some point, you want to see a decision made. Now, of course, there's nothing holding a gun to their heads. Maybe there's no real difference between announcing it now and going ahead and waiting another week. Does it really affect anything? Are you going to lose out on a potential managerial candidate if you wait an extra 6 or 7 days? No, it just looks bad. It just has the perception of looking indecisive, and maybe they don't care about that. And if it means that they make the right decision for the ball club, then that's the decision that they make. But as we sit here and as we wait, I think it's kind of unfair to Kapler too. It kind of leaves him hanging in the wind. Because let's be honest, Kapler is going to be, if they decide to go with Kapler, one of the other things that could be holding this up is a contract extension. I really don't think they're going to bring Kapler back and let him play out the last year of his deal. My guess is that they would give him an extra year so that he doesn't go into 2020 as a lame duck. He runs a pretty loose ship in that clubhouse anyway, but what kind of ship would he be able to run if his players knew that he was a lame duck manager? That it could very well be and probably would be his last season. What kind of authority would he have? That's why most managers don't like to go into a season on the final year of a contract. There might not be anything that Kapler can do about it this time around, but part of the delay could be if they are going to bring him back, signing him to a one-year extension. Although I can't imagine the details of a one-year extension would be all that difficult to hammer out. But one of the things about Kapler and the way he's run this team over the last couple of years, there was some stuff I really didn't like hearing on the Jim Salisbury podcast, the At the Yard podcast that came out earlier this week. talking about a clubhouse that lacked a sense of urgency and no real direction. And that was the theme we talked about on this podcast, about how when things were not going well this summer, the Phillies just kept saying over and over again, and you kept hearing from Gabe Kapler saying over and over again, well, it's just one game. It doesn't define our season. We got another game tomorrow. It's, you know, we got time to get back on track. There's time to make a run. You know, you keep saying that over and over again. The players start to think it too. The players start to not play with a sense of urgency. Well, you know, we've got tomorrow. We've still got some time. As the Phillies found out this year, it gets late pretty early. And that September schedule was no joke. When the Phillies had a chance to bank some wins in July and August, they didn't do it. And so when September came around and they really had to go on that run that everybody was talking about, they had to play all those road games against all those teams over 500, and that's when the bottom fell out of this season. You can't sit there and say over and over again, well, we've got time. Well, there's no big deal. We'll figure it out. We'll make it happen. We'll make it work. That kind of attitude seeps into the clubhouse and into the players, and that's some of the stuff that Salisbury was talking about. He also talked about how they overloaded players with information. And how they asked players to do things they couldn't do. You saw that with Zach Eflin. They tried to get Zach Eflin early in the season to throw his fastball up in the zone, and it worked for a while, but then as he got tired, the fastball came down. He couldn't do it consistently. He had the tired body. And I think now I have a better sense for what the tired body was all about. He simply did not have the physical ability to hump high fastballs at 94, 95 miles an hour all season long. That's not the type of pitcher he is. He came up as a ground ball pitcher. He came up as a sinker ball pitcher. They tried to make him something else, and it wore him out. He couldn't do it. And so when he got back from the bullpen and got back from reliever Siberia, where they weren't using him at all, he decided, you know what, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down as the pitcher that I've always come up as. And I'm going to go down as the sinker ball guy. And we saw him pitch much better in the second half, to the point where I think he's earned a spot in the rotation next year, unless the Phillies make a bunch of moves with the rotation this offseason that I'm not seeing. He said the players essentially turned into robots, and that Kapler was managing by a data sheet a lot of times. That whole thing about numbering the pitching and hitting matchups 1 to 100, I know there are other teams that do that, but that can't be the only thing you're looking at. That can't be, and I don't know, maybe, you know, that move late in the season where they pitched to Freddie Freeman with Adam Duvall on deck, with Aaron Nola on the mound, where Freeman hits that big two-run single to cost the Phillies an important game against Atlanta. Was that because they went away from the 1 to 100 sheet or because they were adhering to it? That's what we don't know. We don't know that stuff. And so it's hard to know what to blame. It's hard to know what to put your finger on. But I think as the Phillies are looking at Gabe Kapler, and that he is certainly under the microscope right now, you wonder if the longer this goes on, whether bigger changes are going to be made. Are they looking at Matt Klentak? That would seem unlikely to me. He just signed an extension this offseason. After getting Bryce Harper, they signed him to a 3-year extension that takes him through the year 2022. I can't imagine his star has fallen that precipitously after John Middleton talked him up so much at the beginning of the season, comparing him to Branch Rickey, saying what a genius the guy was, how he mapped out this offseason that was objectively perfect. We're seeing now there were a lot of holes in the offseason, even though we thought that he did a pretty good job. My problems with Matt Klentak were some of the stuff in season. But you have to look at a general manager's decisions. And certainly in the moment that a general manager makes a decision, you can make an argument that virtually almost all the time a decision is defensible. Almost in every instance, a decision that you make in the moment is defensible. But general managers are judged based on what worked and what didn't. And so let's go over what has worked for Matt Klentak and what has not worked for Matt Klentak so far. I think choosing Bryce Harper over Manny Machado worked. So these are the things I think have worked for Matt Klentak. And I'm not going to count the little tiny moves. We're going to talk major moves here. Bryce Harper over Manny Machado was the right decision. Now, we were hearing all offseason that Machado was Klentak's preferred choice, and that Harper may have been the preferred choice of Middleton and others in the organization. We don't know for sure. If it was Klentak pushing for Machado and Harper won out, then this is not a win for Klentak. But I'm going to put it in the win column for him because he was the general manager and this is the decision that they made. Trading for JT Realmuto is a move he got right. But it's only correct if they sign Realmuto to an extension. Trading for Corey Dickerson was a good move. And I guess you could talk about trading for Jay Bruce was a good move because they gave nothing up. But did it really help the team all that much this year? It helped them for about 3 weeks. And then Jay Bruce disappeared. Corey Dickerson helped them in August. And then he was hurt for most of September. But when Dickerson was in there, he kept the Phillies afloat. He provided a ton of offense in left field. That was a good trade. He traded for Jeremy Hellickson. We don't remember Jeremy Hellickson all that fondly, but he got Hellickson for nothing, and Hellickson provided a year and a half of very good pitching before the bottom fell out. He picked Adam Haseley in the first round. I like Haseley. I think that's a good pick. Haseley looks like a good young baseball player. I think he's going to be the starter in center field next year. I don't know if he's going to be an all-star, but I think he can be a productive player. He traded for Jose Alvarez. Alvarez was one of the most dominant left-handers in the Phillies bullpen this year. He was a very, very good pickup, and you know, at this point, I think that's, is that it? Are those the good moves? Because let's look at what hasn't gone right. We can ask, if they fire Gabe Kapler, obviously hiring Gabe Kapler was a move that didn't go right. And then you could ask yourself the question, was firing Pete Maccann something that should have been done? I think if they're going in an analytical direction, they probably did need to move on from Pete Maccann, but you have to wonder, Maccann had those players responding to him. They played very well in the second half of 2017. How would this team be right now with this analytics department and Pete Maccann in there? It's an open question. Nobody knows. But if they let go of Kapler, you have to call that a move that didn't work out. At the very least, it's impossible to tell with Kapler just yet. He signed Odubel Herrera to a 5-year extension. Obviously, that wasn't looking good even based on the performance on the field before the domestic violence charges. That looks like a disaster now. Trading Ken Giles. I liked the idea. I liked the move at the time, but the Phillies essentially got nothing for him. Vince Velasquez is the most productive thing to come out of that trade, and Velasquez will probably not be a part of this team next year. If he is, maybe he's in the bullpen. But in what role? Mark Appel was the number two guy in that deal, and he flamed out. They banked on Mark Appel being a decent, you know, that maybe a change of scenery would make him into a decent pitcher. Didn't work out, obviously. Mark Appel is retired, and none of the other players from that deal panned out. They failed to pick up the option on Charlie Morton's contract after the 2016 season. When Charlie Morton talked about how much he loved playing in Philadelphia, how he felt in spring training that year that the ball was exploding out of his hand, and then he got hurt with a hamstring injury five starts into the season. The coaching staff told, and this was reported by John Heyman last year, the coaching staff told Matt Klentak that they thought that Charlie Morton should come back, that they should pick up his play, that they should pick up his option. Matt Klentak decided not to do that. And we're going to talk more about Morton in just a second. He failed to sign him as a free agent this offseason. I think that's the bigger mistake. He's only signed a 2-year, $30 million deal with Tampa. How are the Phillies not in that conversation? You've heard me rail about Morton before, the fact that they didn't go after him hard. He should have been their number one target this offseason, let alone ignoring him completely. The Carlos Santana signing didn't work out because Matt Klentak just said, all right, well, let's put Santana at first base. Let's put Rhys Hoskins out in left field. Hoskins, well, I'm sure he'll be able to make it work out there. It was a disaster. Santana didn't hit. Jake Arrieta came out this week, and I don't know how much I believe in Arrieta's comments about a good clubhouse, but Arrieta talked about how much Carlos Santana's presence was a hindrance in the locker room last year, and Santana then leaves here and then is an all-star in Cleveland this year. So what the hell happened? Signing Carlos Santana and moving Hoskins to left field was a disaster that they rectified this past offseason. I mean, at least they were smart enough and not stubborn enough to hold on to that idea. They rectified it and tried to make it better. But they signed Jake Arrieta. I'm as guilty for pushing the Phillies to sign Jake Arrieta as anyone. It was a terrible idea. Obviously, re-signing Charlie Morton to a 1-year deal, giving him that option, would have been far better than signing Jake Arrieta to a 3-year deal. Signing Michael Saunders to a free agent contract blew up in their face. Picking Mickey Moniak remains to be seen. So far, it's not a move that's worked out. I guess maybe we should put that in the impossible to tell area. His 2018 trade deadline moves as Drubal Cabrera, Wilson Ramos, Aaron Loop, Justin Bour, and Jose Bautista, none of them helped. None of them worked out. Signing David Robertson this offseason, good idea, didn't work out. And I understand what he was going for there. It's hard to blame Klentak for that one, but it didn't work out. Signing Tommy Hunter and Pat Neshek, didn't work out. They did not add a significant starting pitcher last offseason. They didn't add anything at the 2019 trade deadline other than Dickerson that helped. They didn't get enough help for the bullpen. They didn't sign Dallas Keuchel. this year when they could have and should have. Not to a three-year deal that would have cost you a draft pick, but a one-year deal prorated over half a season. Instead, he goes to the Atlanta Braves and Keuchel starting game one of the National League Division Series. And frankly, the trade of Freddie Galvis for Eniel De Los Santos is probably a wash. We'll see. De Los Santos, I think, has a nice future. That looks like it could be a pretty good trade. It traded for Gene Segura in exchange for Santana and J.P. Crawford. I think Segura certainly is better than Crawford. Santana, I don't know what happened with Santana that he blew up this year and became such a better hitter. Segura had a disappointing season at shortstop, and now it came out this week, and this is something else that drives me crazy, that they want to move Segura to second base, that they traded for him with the idea in mind that they would move him off of shortstop. What? So we can put Kingery at shortstop? Kingery is a natural second baseman. He can hack it at shortstop, but the thinking must be that both guys would be better that it would be better to have Segura at second and Kingery at shortstop than the other way around. I'm not buying that. I'm not seeing that at all. Signing Scott Kingery to a big league contract before he ever played a game, was that a smart idea? Kingery had a good first half and not a good second half at all. You didn't need to do that. And they certainly, by giving him that contract, I think rushed his development last year. Now, I think it all eventually came out in the wash because he did play well this season for most of the season. But the Charlie Morton situation is particularly interesting because instead of picking up the option, that same offseason Morton signed with the Astros, the Phillies then went out and signed Clay Buchholz, Joaquin Benoit, and Michael Saunders. This team has had no ability to find the guys around the margins. That's what an analytics team is supposed to be able to do. Find guys around the margins. Make improvements around the margins. I have found more $20 bills inside the cushions of my couch than the Phillies have found around the margins. Maybe you want to say Corey Dickerson is one of those moves. Guy was a known quantity. That was just a case of the Pirates looking to just dump some salary and just get rid of somebody. They didn't discover Corey Dickerson. Who has this team uncovered? With all of their numbers and all of their analytics, who have they found? Who have been the diamonds in the rough? Was Drew Smyly supposed to be one of those guys? He isn't. The Phillies have not, and it's fair to wonder, would Charlie Morton have developed into the pitcher he is in Philadelphia? He went to Houston, a place where they seem to turn pitchers around with the flip of a switch, like Thanos snapping his fingers. So I don't know if Morton stays that he's the pitcher that he is now. But the Phillies have not been able to find those guys around the margins, whether it be bullpen guys, whether it be hitters, whether it be especially starting pitchers. They haven't been able to improve the guys that they know have talent that were already here. Nick Pivetta, Vince Velasquez, Zach Eflin. So this is the problem right now that the Phillies have, and maybe this is one of the things they're talking about, one of the reasons it's taking so much time. I mean, look, deliberation is good. It's good to be deliberate. But at some point, as a decision maker, a choice has to be made and a direction has to be charted. And I think that's one of the things that worries me most about this team. What direction is this franchise going in? They've charted this course in analytics, and I agree with it. But they don't seem to have anyone there who knows what to do with it. They're like a dog who caught the car, and now they don't know what to do with it. They either need to bring in a bunch of people to help them figure this all out or make some big changes. Because this is not working. What is the direction of this team right now? Where are they going? You've got so many people calling for the Phillies to go back to old school. I don't think that's what needs to be done, but there has to be some kind of some improvement in managing all of this information that's coming in, teaching it to people, teaching it to players, and getting everybody on the same page. This team needs a direction. They need the owner to step up and chart a course for this organization. And if that means, maybe it means one of two things. Maybe it means you blow everybody out. You blow out McPhail, you blow out Klentak, and you blow out Kapler. Or maybe it means you say, this is the course we've charted. These are the guys we've chosen. I'm keeping all three. We're gonna make things better. We're going to bring some more people in, but we're keeping McPhail. We're keeping Klentak. We're keeping Kapler. We're just going to do it better, and we're going to move forward with these guys. This is the direction we've charted. Do I think that's what's going to happen? I do not. I think Kapler is going to be let go. But is that all? With each passing day that goes by, With each day of Kapler watch that goes by, leads me to think maybe more things are in store. It's just very odd that no one from the Phillies has said anything yet, now that we are almost a full week since the end of the 2019 season and the Major League playoffs are in full swing. Paul Boyer from The Good Fight is going to join me to talk about more of this up next here on Hittin' Season. And joining me to talk a little bit about the seemingly never-ending silence over what the Phillies are going to do with the manager spot is Paul Boyer, great writer for The Good Fight. You can follow him on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Paul, welcome back to Hittin' Season, buddy. How are you?
Hello there, Johnny, baby. I am feeling okay. Thank you so much for having me back.
Absolutely. And you're the guy I wanted to talk to this week about everything going on with the front office and why it is. I'll ask you flat out. Why? why is this happening? Well, I mean, seriously, I think it's mind-boggling to all of us who follow this team why this is taking so long, one way or the other.
Yeah, I don't fully follow it. I understand wanting to do due diligence and try and wait as long as you can to get a feel for if you're going to make a change, what candidates are going to be out there, and maybe get a temperature check of a few guys. The only reason I can think for this to stretch into next week would be if there are changes up above the field manager.
Yeah.
Because that's a pretty cut and dry thing, right? We've seen a number of teams already, either because the manager is retiring or they've relieved them of their duties already. Like, there are a number of vacancies already out there.
Yeah.
We've got a quarter of the league already looking for new managers.
Right.
And we're, you know, just barely into the playoffs. The Phillies are dragging their feet. And if this was just a managerial thing, if this was just a field manager thing, I really don't see why it would take that long.
Yeah.
And maybe eventually nothing happens. It's entirely possible that everybody comes back. I really don't know. But it wouldn't take that long just to give a vote of confidence in the manager if you wanted to stick with him, and mm-hmm. his seat was the only one in question going into 2020. I'm struggling a little bit to really rationalize this, because the Phillies keep a tight lid on things. They don't usually let things leak, and things take a while for to come out, and for us as the public to really get a feel for what's going on in there. But this one just feels weird. This one feels unusual, and I think there's something else going on, whether something ultimately comes of it or not.
And I think they recognize that the way they're approaching this is different from how everybody else is approaching it, because you mentioned seven teams already have made a decision to let their manager go. So what makes this situation special? What makes this situation so different that it takes 2 full weeks after the season is over, when it's not like John Middleton was, you know, Norman Brayman, that guy in France who doesn't pay attention to what's going on with his team during the course of the season? Middleton's pretty dialed in, I think, and he was in Washington last week with the team, talking to players, conducting exit interviews. I really don't, it's mind-boggling to me if we are just talking about the manager. And Jim Salisbury tweeted on, and he wrote a story for NBC Sports Philadelphia on Thursday night, that he's hearing that it is going to last until next week, and that they are still just pondering Gabe Kapler's future, that there apparently isn't anything larger than that. But I'm still skeptical about that. I still think I can't understand why seven other teams made a decision about their manager, why it didn't take them 2 weeks to figure out whether or not this is the guy that they want. And to me, Paul, if it's taking you 2 weeks after the season to decide if Gabe Kapler is your manager, I think it's about more than just deciding whether or not you think Gabe Kapler is good or not. I think you hit on it a little bit there, and I talked a little bit about it beforehand. They may have an idea about one or two guys that they think could be upgrades. But if they don't have one of those two guys, if they don't have assurances from one of those two guys, they might decide to stick with Kapler. And man, that would put Kapler in a really difficult spot.
Yeah, and you know what? He's kind of in a bad spot anyway. You know, you can think what you want of the guy, and I know there's a wide swath of opinions out there that go in both directions. I found myself creeping more back toward the center of it all myself over the last couple of years. But no matter what you feel about the guy, this isn't really fair to him.
It's not.
Either way. If you have a guy who's out in the lurch here, who has a year on his contract, sure, but whose job status has been firmly called into question, not just by the fans, but by the people covering the team.
And they can't plead ignorance on that. They know that that's out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you leave a guy twisting in the wind like this and bring him back after all of that, well, he's starting three steps behind everybody else at that point. And then if you do eventually let him go, well, then what was the circus for? What was with all the radio silence? Why did it take so long to come to that decision? What is going on here? It just doesn't feel right. Yeah. And if it is only about Kapler, it's not fair. But that's why I think there's something else going on here, because, you know, as stead as the Phillies can be sometimes in their public facing persona, I don't necessarily think they'd be unfair to a guy just because they were trying to decide whether to keep him around for one more season. Something right. doesn't add up there to me.
Yeah, I mean, maybe part of the deal is that they know that if they bring him back for another season, unless they want him to enter 2020 as a lame duck manager, they got to tack on another year onto his contract. And especially in the wake of waiting 2 weeks to make an announcement about his future, if you then let him come into next season without another year added on the end of that deal, that's going to look really bad. I mean, he's not going to have any authority in the clubhouse, and that's not fair to him either. So I just don't understand. I think it also makes... You know, in the Salisbury piece, he talks about John Middleton being a deliberate decision maker. You know, that to me, what we've got going on here does not show good leadership. It does not show that somebody is taking control of this thing. You know, who are we talking to? How many different people does it take to talk to about removing a manager? I mean, I think we both agree there's probably some disagreement among the front office personnel. I would almost guarantee that Matt Klentak is stumping for Kapler. Who knows if Andy McPhail is even aware that the Phillies have a manager at this point. But like who else is in the conversation here in the front office? Who are we talking to outside the organization? And why would you talk to people outside the organization who aren't aware of what's going on with your club on a day-to-day basis about this sort of thing? I'm just not sure. Like, what is the criteria here we're using? Who are the people that we're talking to that this takes 2 full weeks to do it? And the other thing here is I've gotten some pushback on Twitter by people saying there's no rush. This, you know, why shouldn't they take their time on this? Can you think of it seems obvious to me that it's a bad idea, but are there any other practical reasons why it's a bad idea to draw this out the way it has been?
It's a really good question.
I think it's fair. I'm trying to think about it, and it just, you know, It seems to scream a lack of direction to me.
I really don't have enough confidence to say that or go that far. Mm-hmm. But I do know that from the outside, knowing what little we know and the number of managerial changes and off seasons that we've all lived through at this point, that I just keep going back to something not really feeling right. There's definitely some indecision going on here. That I think that's absolutely correct, but I just don't know where the indecision lies. Is it on one front with the manager? Is it on two fronts with the field manager and the general manager? Is it on three fronts? Do we have somebody higher up who's thinking of detaching himself from this whole operation? I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever's going on here, they're trying to figure out a plan, I think, before announcing anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're just going to emerge from this next week and end up with the same staff that we ended the season with. You know, yeah. I don't really get a feel either way that here's where it comes back. Now, let me bring this back for a second. A lot of this comes down to me not really thinking this team is going to go into this offseason with a real sense of urgency. I think they're going to look back at last season as one plagued by some bad circumstance, not necessarily by their process, because they assembled a better team than the one they had in 2018. Then they had some injuries. The Cutch injury sucked. Losing an entire bullpen to injury sucked. I think they're probably, whether they truly believe this or not, and I hope they don't truly believe this and they just try and spin it a certain way, that they can go into 2020 without needing to make any real big moves, maybe add a pitcher, maybe clean things up in the infield and figure out where all of those guys are going to play, but not necessarily making a big splash. Maybe they'll justify not spending for Gerrit Cole or something like that, thinking, we actually had a pretty good team. You'll see. We'll let it ride. You'll see. And I think that standpoint, if it's true, I'm getting into a whole bunch of different things here, but if that's true, then I think they come back with the same folks intact, the same management, because well, why wouldn't they? Yeah. If they believe in that team and they believe in the personnel that they have on the 40-man roster right now, well, why not run it back for another year and try and prove out their hypothesis? It feels like it's going that way. I don't know if it will, but it feels like it's going that way.
I could certainly see that happening, but my thinking would be, if that's how they really felt, then we would have had our end of year news conferences already announcing that everybody was going to be back.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think
they obviously need to find a new hitting coach, and I think there could probably be a discussion about pitching coach and whether or not they're going to move on from Chris Young because of some of the stuff we learned from that Athletic story last week. But you know, if they felt like, well, we just had a lot of bad luck this year. We were really bit by the injury bug. We had some veteran players who didn't perform up to their normal standards. Rhys Hoskins, I don't know what happened to him, but he'll bounce back next year. You know, we had a starter or two this offseason. We'll be fine. And you know, Kapler, given all those problems, we still improved one game over last year. If that's how they were going into this, I can't imagine why it would take them this long to say, we're running it back, you know?
That's reasonable, yep.
So, I mean, it seems like they are definitely considering some changes here. And if they were considering changes that didn't involve Gabe Kapler here, if they were trying to figure out, okay, who else are we going to bring in to help? Maybe we bring in some additional people to help Kapler and to help the rest of the analytics people and the front office guys use this data more efficiently and effectively. Or we're going to bring in more teachers to teach players how to analyze this data without it overwhelming them when they're on the field. You know, maybe that stuff, they can say that in the news conferences, but I keep going back to the fact that last year, Matt Klentak held his end-of-year news conference on October 1st. Andy McPhail was on October 2nd. And as we record this late in the evening on October 3rd, and it certainly doesn't seem like there's going to be any kind of announcement on October 4th or 5th or 6th or at the very least 7th, maybe we hear from somebody on Monday, that you know, we're still waiting, and that's unusual given what we saw last year. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think there's every possibility that they could just run it back. But then in that case, I'm wondering what the hell is taking so long, and you know, what are you guys looking at? What are you guys trying to figure out?
Fair point. And I will be very interested to see how this all plays out and how those press conferences go, whoever ends up attending them, and the kinds of answers that they throw out to the questions that are sure to come. Because the longer this goes on, the more those questions are going to pile up.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No doubt about it. And that's why they're not holding these things. They need to have all their ducks in a row before they go out and before they meet the media. And I as this has gone on, you know, I have been speculating, others have been speculating, and you mentioned it too when you first came on, whether or not larger changes are being made. And obviously, some people are looking at the general manager now, because I don't think people thought that Matt Klentak's job was in jeopardy, but the fact that this has gone on a little bit longer than anybody thought, okay, now the mind starts to wander a little bit, because like you said, like we have both said, if you're just talking about getting rid of Gabe Kapler, this probably could have been something that we would thought would have been done in a day or two, but now this is dragging out. And I mentioned in the first segment all the things that I feel like Matt Klentak has gotten right, some of the things I think have gone wrong for him, some of the stuff I think it's still too early to say. I want to get your thoughts on Matt Klentak's tenure as a general manager so far. It doesn't sound like from Salisbury's piece as if Klentak is part of the equation here as far as whether or not to remove him from his position. What is your feeling on the Phillies general manager now that we have a solid amount of data to look back on and see, I guess, what, over 4 years now? This will be his fourth offseason, or this will be his fifth offseason? I have to do the math.
Yeah, you know, I always thought that general managers take far longer for us to come to any sort of conclusion than just about anybody in baseball, because you have to look at it from not just what the major league product is like, but what they're doing and coordinating down on the farm. And they have farm directors to help with that, obviously, but it's their ship. And you have to look at how the farm system evolves under their tenure, what they're doing to bolster things along the margins, not just making the big moves. And I think that's where things start to get a little shaky, because big moves, okay, yeah, check the boxes. He was able to get Arrieta for what at the time seemed like a pretty good deal late in the offseason, picking up a starting pitcher who had been on the market forever. He was able to get Bryce Harper, which, okay, great. It's pretty obvious that that guy's really talented, so you know you had to go out and spend for him. He picked up Real Muto. Okay, awesome. Another obviously talented player who you had to give up your organization's best prospect to get. Okay, I feel like that's a move a lot of general managers can make. And then you start thinking about what happens at the trade deadlines. And it gets a little bit dumber. You know, I don't like the half measure approach that's begun to emerge there. You know, you look at 2018 with the slew of people that they picked up there, and you listed these out. We have Asdrubal Cabrera, Wilson Ramos, Aaron Loop, Justin Bour, and Jose Bautista, all at the deadline or shortly thereafter in August of 2018. It's a lot of guys. It's a lot of guys.
Yeah.
That's a lot of pickups, a lot of major league pickups, even though Ramos wasn't ready immediately and there was a little bit of time to add him. You look at all of that and you're like, well, none of those guys are really difference makers. Ramos was a nice bat, but he could barely move and wasn't a great defensive catcher when he
didn't play for the first month they had him, too. Right. I had to wait a month for him.
Exactly. Cabrera basically went in the tank. He did nothing coming over from the Mets. Loop was okay and then got hurt, barely pitched. Bour was fine. Some people wanted to replace Carlos Santana with him, which is just speaks to the crazy. Yeah. Remember 2018? Wasn't that wonderful? And then Jose Bautista, who's actually fine, but he's, you know, he was a 40-year-old corner outfielder and wasn't going to be around for very long anyway. And then you fast forward to this year. Okay, Corey Dickerson for a song, that's cool, but he was also hurt and damaged goods, so you're kind of just going along the margins there, whatever.
Yep.
And nobody else that they've added at the deadline has really done anything for them.
No.
I guess you could count Jay Bruce among that. He was in June, I believe, shortly before the McCutcheon injury.
Yeah.
But even then, he fell in the tank shortly after his hot 2 weeks.
Yeah, he gave you 2.5 weeks there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and then you flip the script. You look at the Braves, who are in the playoffs now, and over the last couple of years, they've added guys on the margins like Adam Duvall, Adany Echevarria, Billy Hamilton, and then they make some slightly bigger moves with Shane Green, Mark Melancon. But then in the mid-tier, they pick up guys like Chris Martin from the Rangers, who are these sneaky good players who can really make an impact, and they find the ways to pry them away. And the Phillies haven't been able to do that. They haven't found a guy at any of these deadlines to really bolster their team, to really support what's going on and help them stay in the hunt. The guys that they've been adding, you know, Corey Dickerson did almost all of the work for every guy that the Phillies picked up, the slew of relievers that they picked up with Parker and Morin and Hugh, and most of them did nothing. Parker was fine, but he didn't pitch that much. And the rest of them were just, you know, either lobbing aphises or giving up home runs. It just hasn't worked out. And I think that's been a huge crushing thing to just get wrong at the deadline every year. I mean, think about some of the guys that they didn't trade to, say, pick up Manny Machado in 2018. Zach Eflin and Adonis Medina were on the table, if I remember right. Those were two guys that were thought of pretty highly at the time and were potentially involved in some kind of package that could have landed them Machado as a rental. And you look at Eflin, he's fine. He had a few good starts and a few really bad starts this year and is maybe a number three, if you want to be optimistic about that. And Adonis Medina took huge steps backward. Now, I know you can't predict these things, and if you had a crystal ball, then, okay, with hindsight, you'd go back and make every deal that was proposed at the time if you knew it was going to happen.
Right.
But they're getting things wrong. They're not getting it right.
Yep.
And I think that's what's frustrating, because you look at the process going in and it's all about adding small pieces, really small little things here and there, figuring, okay, maybe in 2018 they didn't want to go all in because they didn't think they were competitive. Maybe in 2019 they were already kind of slipping, so they didn't want to wager something. It's really tentative and really cautious, and even then it's still going wrong. The guys they're picking up aren't working. They're bad. They're hurting. And something about the approach to these things and picking up these players has to be a little different, because it doesn't seem like great process, and then the results that follow usually aren't great either.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned something about finding talent in the margins, and that's not something this team has been able to do. And you mentioned the trade deadline acquisitions. I mean, isn't that what teams, analytically driven teams, are supposed to be good at? Is the whole reason you have all this data and you have all these numbers is to try and find those diamonds in the rough, like Charlie Morton. It seemed like maybe they were gonna get that guy back in 2016 in spring training. He talked about how good his arm felt and his velocity was up with the Phillies that year in the few starts that they had, and they had the opportunity to bring him back on a 1 year team option. The Phillies coaches said to Klentak they thought they should bring Charlie Morton back, and he decided to go a different direction, and instead they went out and they got Michael Saunders and Clay Buchholz and Joaquin Benoit, you know. So I mean, those are the kinds of decisions I think that really hurt a general manager. And you look at the big trade that he made when he first got here, when we thought, man, Matt Klentak is going to be a West Coast gambler. You know what I mean? Like he's going to a Western, like one of those Western gunslingers, I think is more the point I mentioned when he made the Ken Giles trade. Well, they got nothing for that Ken Giles trade. I mean, Vinny Velasquez has given them a couple of years of starts, but he hasn't been an above average starter. He hasn't really been anything special at all. We're still here 3-4 years later winning for Vinny Velasquez to break out, and it's not going to happen. So that trade looks bad. I mean, the Gene Segura trade, here's the other thing that really got me thinking about Klentak, because I've kind of pushed back at people who give Klentak a really hard time. I think we all thought he had a good offseason this year. Most of Klentak's moves, in the moment when he makes them, we all think to ourselves, oh, that's probably a pretty good move. But that's, you know, at the end of the day, your moves have to work, you know, and that's kind of the deal. But the thing that happened this week that really has me questioning Klentak is now they want to move Segura to second base, and that they acquired him with the idea of moving him off of shortstop after, say, a year or so. And so they go out and they get Segura, who plays shortstop, to fill shortstop, but the plan is to move him to second base, even though you've already signed Scott Kingery to a long-term major league deal. And you still have Cesar Hernandez, who technically is still going to be under team control next year because he's arbitration eligible. So what's, like, where is the forward thinking here? Where is, how are we mapping this out? It just seems like the Phillies and Klentak go out of their way to make things harder on themselves than they have to be, and trying to fit, they want to make all these players play all these different positions, like the Dodgers have all their guys moving all over the place, but they don't have the personnel to do it. They're trying to make their pitchers pitch a certain way, even though that's not where their strengths lie. Zach Eflin, for example. So that's part of the other issue that I have with Matt Klentak here. Not only is he kind of pushing the wrong buttons in some cases, I'm not sure he's got a winning idea of what kind of a team to put on the field.
The word that comes to mind for me that they keep adding into the mix with some of these moves is disruption. There's a lot of disruption that comes out in the ripple effects from some of these moves. We're seeing that with Segura now, but we also had that with a couple other things. Most notably, the fact that the team didn't do anything with Nick Williams after picking up Andrew McCutchen and Bryce Harper.
Yeah.
I think that stands out as, especially now, given the way this season just went for Nick, who I can't help but feel terrible for. When you pick up two other corner outfielders and you have Nick Williams, who cannot play center field, what purpose does it serve to immediately turn this 25-year-old into a full-time bench player like that? I'm not sure what really happened there. I think in the same story you were mentioning, the same Athletic story you were mentioning, there's a mention that Williams' representatives were trying to push the Phillies to get a trade for Williams.
Yeah.
I can't blame them at all.
No.
I mean, I'm certain they saw the writing on the wall once they had a better play. And hey, look, this is one of those cases where you add guys like Andrew McCutchen and Bryce Harper. I mean, Nick Williams had a fine run here, and he's probably gone. I'm saying this as if he's gone when he's still on the team, but he had a fine run here. He is not either one of those two players. If those players are available, you make that upgrade. But what you have to do after that is figure out the right way to handle what you already have in-house. And they didn't handle Nick Williams correctly at all. That guy, you could see it just throughout the course of the year. It played out in his body language. He was sad, I think, to be on this team. It was a sad experience for him playing baseball in this organization this year. And that's not something you want to see. So that's one example, and the Segura thing is going to be a second. Again, they're painting themselves into a corner with three guys now who I guess they envision is playing second base in some degree, but only one of them can really do it. Signing Carlos Santana to move Rhys Hoskins to left field. Like, there are a lot of things that they think are going to work that don't work.
Yeah, yeah. That's the legacy so far. That's a perfect way of putting it. That is the legacy so far. There's a lot of things that they think are going to work, but don't work. I think that That is an absolutely perfect way to sum up the Phillies under this regime right now. Well, let's take a look at some of the other openings that are out there for managers' jobs. And I think the Phillies job is an interesting job. I don't know that it's the best job out there. I'm sure it's not, as a matter of fact.
No.
So let's talk about the fact that you've got the Padres and the Pirates and the Giants and the Royals, the Angels, the Cubs, and the Mets today announced that they were firing Mickey Callaway. So I'll ask you, why don't you rank where you think the Phillies job would be amongst those seven jobs and give me your ranking of the top eight jobs that would be open if the Phillies decide to move on from Gabe Kapler?
Well, yeah, sure. So I think number one with a bullet is the Padres job.
That's my top one, too. Yep.
Yeah, geographically, yeah, sure, that's great. But you also have Fernando Tatis Jr. To lead your entire position player base and a guy like Chris Paddock to anchor your rotation. It's really hard not to be excited at the prospect of managing guys like that. Mm-hmm. Also knowing that the ownership group is willing to spend. Yeah, the Eric Hosmer thing isn't really working out, but they're willing to fork over the money, as they did with Machado as well. So back-to-back off seasons, they've been willing to fork it over.
Yep.
Who knows? Maybe they could be surprise players for Gerrit Cole this winter. They're willing to do what it takes. They're building something interesting, even if it hasn't become fully formed yet. And I definitely think that's a team to keep an eye on for the next couple of years. After them, I would put the Giants. I think the Giants still have some work to do, but they also have a good ownership base. They have folks who want to win. I'm certain that they're not content with what's happened the last couple of years. And yes, Buster Posey and Brandon Belt and Brandon Crawford as the old guard are starting to fall away a little bit. Mm-hmm. But some of the players have been pleasant surprises that I wasn't really expecting to see break out quite like this. I think Mike Yastrzemski comes to mind. He's a little bit on the older side, but he's had a really nice season. And who knows? Maybe they can crank out a couple of other interesting players we've never heard of before Joey Bart comes around and starts anchoring himself behind the plate for another couple of years. Mm-hmm. I think there's something cooking there, even if it'll take one more not great year to really fully emerge. I think the Giants' job is interesting. And then third, I would put the Angels, mostly because he got Mike Trout.
Yeah, Trout and Ohtani. Trout and Ohtani, that's what you got there. Yep.
Yeah, that's an exciting team, man. It's really hard to go wrong.
And you're in L.A., yeah.
Yeah. And then after that is when I would start considering the Phillies job. I think the Phillies and Mets jobs are right about even, maybe with an edge to the Phillies, just because the Mets ownership is wild. and unpredictable. I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to go into that situation. But the fact is that the Mets, I think, have a better talent base right now than the Phillies do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that.
It's just a little bit of a hairy situation. You kind of have to have an iron stomach for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then after that, you get into some mix of the Cubs, Royals, and Pirates. Take them in any order you like. I think I'm a little down on the Cubs than most people would be, I think, just because I see the current core starting to phase out. Like, next year is going to be okay, but then you start thinking about who among Chris Bryant and Javier Baez is still going to be around in 2 years. Kyle Schwarber is fine, but not really a cornerstone piece. And after that, what else do you really have? You know, Rizzo is under contract for a couple more years, but he can't do it all himself. Wilson Contreras is a nice player, but he's a catcher. He's not going to be able to play 162 games. You're going to have to start managing his workload a little bit. And then, you know, the Royals and Pirates.
Yeah, that's going to be a long climb back up, man.
I don't like it.
No, I agree with you on the Royals and Pirates. They're at the bottom of my list at this point. I have the Padres as the top job as well. When you consider location, you consider all the young talent they have, and they have shown a willingness to spend. I think the Padres are the number one destination for any manager right now in baseball. I have the Mets at number two. I think their ownership is absolutely crazy. There's no doubt about that. Brody Van Wagenen as the GM is still a wild card, but that they've got some great talent on that team. They've got a 50-homer rookie. They've got Michael Conforto, another really good young hitter. Jeff McNeil's a really good young hitter. They've got that rotation, which is special. I think if they get better bullpen, a better bullpen effort than they got this year, they might be in the playoffs. I like that talent, base that they have there. I think they have flat out right now, I think they have more talent than the Phillies do.
Yeah.
I have the Phillies at number three because of all the reasons you just mentioned. There is talent with Philadelphia. They are going to spend money. They've got lots of cash. And, you know, who knows? Maybe Alec Bohm and Spencer Howard and Bryson Stott and whoever they draft this year end up being some guys you can build around internally. But maybe Adam Haseley is one of those guys. But they don't have enough of that kind of stuff. They don't have enough high-end pitching either. And that's hard. You know, that's hard to put together to get the kind of pitching you need to compete against teams like the Nationals and Braves and the Mets. And so there's a lot going for Philadelphia. It's a great sports town as well. So I got the Phillies at number three. I have the Cubs at four. I agree with you. I think the Cubs would be much higher on my list if I didn't think they were going to get rid of Bryant or Baez at some point this year, this offseason or next offseason. I've got the Angels at five. Because I look at the Angels and I say to myself, man, they got Trout and Ohtani and they play in L.A. That's great. And then I look at it and I think, all they have is Trout and Ohtani. There's a lot of work to do in Los Angeles with the Angels. And they're always going to be the number two team in that market. If you're a manager that likes to kind of be second fiddle and not have the spotlight, they're always going to be behind the Dodgers. So maybe that's your place. Then I have the Giants after that, just because I do think it's going to be 2 or 3 years before the Giants are competitive again. It's kind of I think that's a great park. It's a great city, but I think it's going to be a little while before you're winning there. And then the Royals and Pirates are just, those are tough jobs, and they're going to have to be given to someone who is maybe the pitching coach there, and this is going to be their only shot at a job like this. Or for if Kapler gets let go and that's one of the only two teams calling, then maybe you end up going there or something like that. Or Mickey Callaway, if one of those two teams calls Mickey Callaway and says, hey, you know, you went 20 games over 500 in the second half. Maybe you're not terrible. Let's give you another shot. You know, I think the Mets did the right thing. Callaway's pretty awful, but, you know, it was interesting. They had a run differential of plus 100 in the second half, and he got fired.
Amazing.
So, really is amazing how major league teams are kind of looking at managers. All right, Paul, last thing before I let you go. As we speak, the Major League Baseball playoffs are going on. The Nationals and the Rays won the two wild card games. The division series are now in full swing. Do you have a World Series prediction, my friend?
I do. I am riding the dinger train all the way with the Bomba Squad and picking the Twins over the third straight National League pennant winning Los Angeles Dodgers.
Nice. That's a nice pick. Twins over Dodgers.
I'll tell you what, man. There were a lot of home runs hit this year, and saying that is like saying the sky is blue, I know. But yeah. Something about the way the Twins do it, and this is a totally subjective thing. It's unique to me as far as I'm talking right now. Mm-hmm. Something about the way the Twins do it is just way more exciting. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but it's fun. I think it's just because I really like Nelson Cruz and anything around him.
Man, he's still going, man.
He's great. He's fun, man. This is awesome.
Is he
going to
be a Hall of Famer?
That is an awesome question. He got started late, but he's keeping it going for so long that if he manages to play a full season when he's, you know, 39, 40 and is still hitting 20 homers, you got to think about it, right?
I don't know what his career homer total is right now, but he's got to be getting close to 450 or 500, doesn't he? I'm going to look this up while you're talking. But
yeah, he is somebody who's going to be on the periphery, I think, when it comes time to talk about his candidacy and, you know, 7 years or however.
He's at 401, 401 home runs.
So it's a little low, but two more years of 20, and that's conservative for him, gets you in the 450 range, and then you think about it, especially with, you know, the unicorn clause of being unique in his time where he's someone who's aging more gracefully than a lot of players are anymore. I think maybe that bumps him up a little bit. He's definitely not first ballot, but maybe he sticks around for a little while.
Man,
but yes, I like the Twins over the Dodgers in six.
Age 30, you got me on Nelson Cruz's page, on Baseball Reference page, and this is something else. I mean, since he turned 33, 40 homers, 44, 43, 39, 37, and 41 this year.
It's beautiful.
I don't think he's getting in because, I mean, I'm looking at years at his age 25 through 32 seasons, and he had a 30 homer season and like four straight 20 plus homer seasons, but not quite enough production there. He really didn't become a star until he was 32 with Texas back in 2013. But nevertheless, man, what a fun career. What a fun career he's
had. Absolutely.
Well, listen, Paul, I think we're going to have to wait until after the weekend to figure out what's going on with the Phillies. You know, we're just going to take our time here, my friend. But we will check back in with you, and I'm sure you'll have some things to say about it at the Good Fight and on Twitter. Make sure, folks, you're following Paul on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Paul, thanks for coming back on Hitting Season, buddy. I appreciate it.
John, always, always a pleasure.
Well, up next, we're going to talk a little bit about the Major League Baseball playoffs and why I think the wild card, exactly the way it is great for baseball. Plus, a little bit more on the Jake Arrieta versus Carlos Santana war of words going all the way back to last year. This is, they're still fighting. It's really something else. We'll talk about it up next right here on Hitting Season. And we're back on Hitting Season. So before I get to my thoughts about the Major League Baseball wild card, let me get you up to date on what's been going on with Carlos Santana and Jake Arrieta, two veteran players who are a part of the 2018 Phillies team who are still fighting in the media because Jake Arrieta is taking shots at Carlos Santana and Carlos Santana is defending himself. I mean, it's been more than a year since Carlos Santana took his baseball bat and smashed the TVs in the clubhouse because players, he said, were playing Fortnite during the games towards the end of a season in which the Phillies utterly collapsed down the stretch. Arrieta told the Inquirer before the series finale on Sunday, talking about the clubhouse, he was asked, why is it better without Carlos Santana? We had better guys in the clubhouse this year. That's it. A lot more veteran presence. Well, Santana has since responded to that. He responded on Thursday night with a tweet, and he said, I take my job seriously. So if Jake isn't doing the best thing for the team or setting a bad example for the young guys, I'm not going to sit back and support it. Maybe he didn't agree with that. Actions speak louder than words. I loved my time in Philly and wish them the best. Turn the page, Poppy. Apparently, Carlos Santana urging Jake Arrieta to stop living in the past and talking about how terrible Carlos Santana was for the clubhouse last year. And I mentioned a little while ago, it really sticks in the craw a little bit that Santana had a 9-11 OPS and hit 34 home runs this year for Cleveland. But as you remember, you know, it's who do you, I'm trying to decide if I'm Team Arrieta or Team Santana here. You know, I mean, Arrieta back in March was asked about the TV incident, the smashing of the TV incident, and he said communication should have taken place because we could have had a conversation about, okay, I understand that you maybe don't like guys playing video games, but what if someone doesn't like you on your phone watching a movie before the game? It's just a matter of understanding that guys are different. Well, I would say even if guys are different, playing video games while your teammates are playing a game out on the field is not cool. And that's obviously something Carlos Santana objected to. And I got to just say, Jake Arrieta likes to run his mouth. I think we've seen that in his 2 years here, and he likes to run his mouth without his performance on the field backing it up. That's what we've seen from Jake Arrieta. That's been his legacy so far, is running his mouth, throwing teammates under the bus without doing his part of the job. Now, listen, I know he battled through those elbow spurs this year, those bone spurs in his elbow. And that was a tough guy thing to do, and I think his teammates appreciated that. And I give Jake all the credit in the world for doing that, okay? That's not an easy thing to do, to fight through injury like that. Fighting for his teammates, I think that's a great thing. But he's also had a tendency to rip his coaching staff, to rip fellow players, to criticize others, and every once in a while he might throw a finger at himself. But we got a guy here who has not lived up to the contract that he signed when he signed his 3-year, $75 million deal, but he likes to pop off in the papers, going after other people. Now, Jake said at the beginning of the year that he was not one of the guys who was playing Fortnite during games. And so I'll take him at his word on that. But it really is interesting that we're still fighting this battle. That it really goes to show you how rough the 2018 clubhouse was. And really, we're really getting a sense as to why that team faltered down the stretch. And these are supposed to be the veterans. You want to look at why the 2018 team struggled? These are supposed to be your veterans. Carlos Santana and Jake Arrieta, they're supposed to be the veteran guys. And we've got this back and forth in the media still talking about last season. Let's move on, guys. Just like Carlos Santana saying, let's turn the page, Poppy. Let's go ahead and do that. All right, some real quick thoughts about the wild card in the Major League Baseball playoffs. I saw something on Twitter that I think really crystallized my feelings about the wild card. And I know there's a lot of people out there who don't like the fact that you play 162 games and you get one of the two wild cards, and then your season, if you lose, is over in just one game. It's barely the playoffs. It certainly probably doesn't feel like you were in the playoffs if you lose that wild card game. If you win it, sure, it feels like a playoff game. But if you lose it, it feels like lost, you know, game number 163. But I think the wild card is just perfect the way it is. I think it does so much for baseball. For one, it keeps way more teams interested as you go into the season, and it does incentivize winning the division. We do see teams that seem to think the wild card is just as good as winning the division. Now, at a certain point, if you don't play well enough and you're 9 games out of the division as September rolls around, then yes, you focus on the wild card, knowing that it could just be a 1-game playoff. But here's the deal. And John underscore Pielli, who's the host of the Pass Ball Show, which is a podcast, I think, said it best on Twitter. He said, wild card teams are given a gift of playing any postseason baseball. If they do not like it, win the freaking division next time. And that's what you have to look at these wild cards as. They are a gift to the second place teams that maybe they get to play a little bit of bonus baseball. Because for the longest time, second place teams went home at the end of the season. There was no opportunity for them to move on. So you give these two second-place teams in each league a chance to go play in the tournament. You get one game. You get one game. You don't like it? It shouldn't be a best of three. It shouldn't be a best of five, because then that puts all the division winners at a disadvantage, making them wait around for a week. You play one game. It's part of the danger of being a wild card team. It's one of the reasons why the Phillies decided not to be aggressive at the trade deadline this offseason, because they were terrified of losing that wild card game. Now, you can say that that's kind of a defeatist attitude, that that's, you know, a kind of a scaredy cat way of approaching things. Whether that's true or not, it is a reality that you lose that wild card game, you are done. That's it. But I think that's the way it should be. That's the way it's supposed to be. Fight for the division title. Make the pennant race mean something. Make winning the division mean something. It matters. Tell the Braves and the Cardinals and the Dodgers that it doesn't matter winning the division, because it does. We used to see all the time baseball wildcard teams winning the World Series, upsetting the division winners. Now it happens, but not nearly as often, because it does put you at a disadvantage if you are a wild card team. I think it's great exactly the way it is. Do not expand it. Do not make it a 3-game series. These 1-game playoffs are also really exciting. That Nationals-Brewers game, if that had been game one of a 5-game series or a 3-game series, would not have had nearly that much emotion to it, because it's win or go home. It's one of the only times in baseball you get a win or go home scenario, and baseball needs a little bit more of that. Baseball needs a little bit of win-or-go-home drama, and so you get that with the wild cards. I love the wild card games. I think they are perfect the way they are. I think they are utterly fantastic. Do not change a thing about them. All right, now it's time for your stat of the week. There will be at least 7 new managers on opening day in 2020. That's a lot. That will actually be the most new managers on opening day since 2011, and it could be 8 if the Phillies ever decide to make a decision. Folks, that'll do it for episode number 324 of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Paul Boyer for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done so already, gang, please make sure to head on over to the Hittin' Season Patreon. It's at patreon.com/hittin'season. Tell your friends about the Good Fight podcast feed, about Hittin' Season, continued success, and the Dirty Inning. Tell them to go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever it is they like to get podcasts, and subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed, and leave a rating and a review if you get it through Apple Podcasts. That will help the podcast grow. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.